You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Fire and Ice. The women I met at a Louisiana detention center, where I was held for 45 days, demonstrated generosity and compassion through even the darkest times. By Rumesa Ozturk. Opening illustration by Ho-kyung Kim, which shows a woman in profile with three women superimposed on her face. On a Tuesday in March, I had spent most of my day working on my dissertation proposal, growing exhausted and hungry. It was the holy month of Ramadan, and I was fasting. Once finished, I got ready to attend an iftar dinner, throwing on my hoodie, sweatpants, and a jersey headscarf. Definitely not a day for being fancy. I was looking forward to catching up with friends at the Interfaith Center, when I was suddenly surrounded and grabbed by a swarm of masked individuals who handcuffed me and shoved me into an unmarked car. Suddenly, I was thrust into a nightmare. Thousands of questions crept up as my shackled body was jostled from one location to another. Who were these people? Had I been a good enough person if today was my final day? I was relieved to have finished filing my taxes, but I couldn't shake the thought of a book I needed to return to the library. I regretted not calling my grandparents and friends that day. My mom had heard me scream on the phone when they were taking me. As my body shook with fear, I found myself drowning in thoughts. I began my final prayers, communicating with God that I had tried my best every day. I was shuttled from Somerville to another city in Massachusetts, then to New Hampshire and Vermont, followed by Georgia and Louisiana. I experienced countless changes in agents, cars, planes, and handcuffs. In Vermont, I was required to take a DNA test for the first time in my life. I hadn't yet been permitted to contact my parents, friends, or lawyer. I asked numerous questions, but I received few answers. Throughout, I was disoriented, hungry, and nauseous. In Georgia, after suffering a severe asthma attack without my primary inhaler and having a hard cry, I was feeling completely hopeless. In Louisiana, I found myself in a cramped, cage-like bus, waiting for hours. I watched as countless people arrived from a nearby plane, all shackled, hands, feet, and waist. I asked for water, but was given none. I sat with others in uncomfortable seats, all of us feeling the weight of our situations, and me intensely feeling the strain on my body, which was about to collapse. I never could have imagined such an ordeal when I came to the United States in 2018 to pursue my graduate studies. I earned my master's degree in developmental psychology from Columbia University on a Fulbright scholarship. And now I am in the final stage of my doctoral studies at Tufts University, focusing on how young people use social media to benefit others. I am also a dedicated teacher who strives to listen to, support, and care for young people, including undergraduate students at Tufts. And that's why, together with other Tufts graduate students, I co-authored an op-ed in the Tufts Daily, seeking to affirm the equal dignity and humanity of all people. The opinion article urged the university to listen to its undergraduate student body in the democratic resolutions passed by the Tufts Community Union Senate, including acknowledging the Palestinian genocide. Unbelievably, this single opinion piece, published in our student newspaper, would lead to my arrest and detention. It wasn't until late afternoon on March 26th that we arrived at a detention center, roughly 24 hours since I had been grabbed off the street. While waiting to be processed, alongside dozens of other women in a stark white cell, I felt utterly exhausted. The room itself was frustratingly bright, with hard, uncomfortable benches. The bathrooms were just curtain stalls. Later in the night, we were finally given some dinner. My request for halal or vegetarian food was rejected. Still, despite these awful circumstances, I clung to my belief in humanity. I began engaging in conversations with the women around me. Over the 14 hours I spent in processing, I connected with many of them. Through a sometimes challenging language barrier, we talked about how we'd gotten there, where we'd been, and what was waiting for us on the inside. I soon learned the color coding used in the detention center. Orange indicated low crime, meaning those individuals were asylum seekers, their crime being the act of legally seeking asylum or crossing the border without authorization. Women kept asking me, "Did you cross the border?" I answered, "I hadn't. I had a ticket. I had F1 visa one day before. I am a doctoral student." The red uniforms denoted more serious offenses. I came to understand that this facility serves as an immigration detention center where asylum seekers, refugees, and immigrants, people escaping conflict, war, oppression, and violence, are taken and find themselves stuck for months or years. I was given orange. I wondered which border I had crossed without my knowledge. Around 6 a.m. on Thursday, March 27th, having gone two nights without sleep and little food, I was finally processed in the for-profit ICE prison. My request for a space for my morning prayer was rejected by an intake officer. Instead, I was directed to the medical center for my first evaluation, which primarily consisted of me listing my health issues and trying to remember the names of the medications I was taking. I spent hours waiting there under extremely loud TV sounds. Later, when I was directed to where I was to stay in the afternoon, I was bewildered to find 23 other women crowded into a small cell. They greeted me with warmth and smiles, which only added to my confusion. I opened the plastic bag of essentials that the officers had given us, which contained 2 to 3 changes of clothes, flip-flops, a small bottle of shampoo, a comb, 1 thin blanket and sheet, toothpaste, a cheap toothbrush, and a handbook. I wanted to dive into the handbook, but it was written in Spanish. I asked a few of the other women if they had an English version. They did, and they were eager to help me understand everything. They taught me how to do laundry, making sure the bag is tight so the clothes don't get lost. One woman offered me cookies, while the other offered tea, and they both sat down to chat with me. "This place is the worst," they said, telling me about the times when they did not have access to female hygiene products or toilet paper, how they were constantly counted and lined up, how some officers raised their voices, or somehow, even worse, did not even respond. They shared how cold they were in the wintertime, with no extra blankets, jackets, or proper shoes being provided. They shared stories of witnessing violence. The next chapter of my experience in prison began in that moment. Over the next 6.5 weeks, I found myself immersed daily in the love, beauty, resilience, and compassion of these women. We each found ourselves trapped in our own individual nightmares, but we found comfort and relief in one another. In one small room, a world of possibilities unfolded. It transformed into a therapy space, a beauty salon, a hairstyling center, a Pilates studio, a medical center, a massage room, an interfaith temple, and an art studio, all at once, without any tools or resources. We tackled long-standing disputes that have plagued our nations for years, between Armenia and Turkey, Russia and Ukraine, Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. We bonded over our shared experiences, which spanned geographies from Colombia to Iran and Afghanistan to Honduras. During limited times outside in the yard, I walked with many women, listening to their stories. Among us was a singer with almost a million followers, a talented violinist, a Pilates instructor, a visual arts teacher, a devoted mom, a loving grandmother, and a woman with a passion for arranging flowers. Someone's best friend, someone's fiancé, someone's wife, someone's daughter, an aunt, a human rights activist, a human, like all of us, with a heart. And me, a very confused international doctoral student. Although I was comforted by the women around me, every day resembled a new chapter from Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events. We stumbled upon frogs, crawfish, snakes, and bugs in the yard, and were ridiculed by some officers for being afraid. The temperatures in Louisiana were scorching. Our yard time was limited. We constantly faced a choice between the fresh air and shielding ourselves from the sun. In stark contrast, our room felt freezing. To find some relief, we heated plastic water bottles and used them as mini heaters. I've had asthma for several years, but I've never suffered from it like I did in detention, given the damp, dusty, and overcrowded conditions. Once, when I suffered a severe asthma attack, the officers did not respond until many women began banging on the windows to get their attention. Afterward, I was not even allowed to take a few minutes of fresh air, being told that it was a risk to the officer's safety. When our request for care went unanswered by the medical center, we leaned on each other for support. One time, my friend had a severe allergic reaction, and her entire eye became red and itchy. Despite her numerous requests for permission to visit the medical center, she was never given the help we pleaded for. In a desperate attempt to assist her, I used black tea bags on her eyelids to try to reduce the swelling. From cancer to colds to women's diseases, ibuprofen was the magical pill the medical staff offered. My friends had to wait for emergency help for a long time, sometimes for days. Other women shared that they had given up on seeking help, deciding it was better to endure severe health consequences than to visit that center and be treated inhumanely. Some of the medical staff would raise their voices at us. They'd say things like, "You're giving me a headache. Why are you always coming during my shift? And I'm not giving you anything." When I asked questions, they responded that they couldn't babysit me. Many women said that the medical staff did not believe they were sick. They shared how, upon arrival, they were in relatively good health, but their conditions deteriorated day by day due to inadequate access to medical care, nutritious food, sleep, sunlight, and fresh air. They experienced lapses in menstruation, declining mental health, and even hair loss due to overwhelming stress. We worried about our friends with wheelchairs, cancer, a deaf friend, and friends with serious chronic illnesses such as diabetes. We rarely got a proper night's rest. For the first time in my life, I realized that sleep, real sleep, is actually a luxury. The constant glare of fluorescent lighting made it almost impossible to doze off. Many officers marched through the area loudly, their chains and keys clattering, waking us at night with the booming sound of their walkie-talkies. Except one officer, whom we frequently thanked for holding her key and chains so the sound would not disrupt us. All we wanted was uninterrupted, peaceful sleep. In the early days of my detention, I had no access to the commissary, and was growing hungry and desperate, as staff did not honor my request for a meal that met my dietary restrictions for many hours. But my friends generously stepped in to feed me. I remember us sharing two cookies or a package of snacks among many women in the room. My friends offered essentials like toilet paper and shampoo, and generously lent me their pens and a few sheets of paper, since I had none of my own. Women there reported that they voluntarily worked 4 to 5 hours in the kitchen for $3 per day, and in the laundry, commissary, intake, and library for $1 per day. Meals in the dining hall mainly comprised an overwhelming amount of beans, accompanied by some undercooked rice, highly processed bread, and sometimes a rather unappetizing salad. On rare occasions, we'd get a tiny serving of canned fruit. Fresh fruit was rare. We had to rely on instant oatmeal and noodles just to feel full. All these dining experiences left us grappling with digestion issues and persistent stomach aches. We were constantly worried about the pregnant women among us. All we wanted was to be seen as human again. We felt invisible, stripped of our identity as breathing and living human beings. One morning, we were head-counted 7 times in the span of a few hours and woken up from our sleep to be lined up. During head counts, we communicated with our eyes, rejecting the dehumanization and silently agreeing that this is brutal. We longed to be recognized as more than just numbers, no longer reduced to figures in orange uniforms. An Armenian woman I considered an aunt asked me every time I saw her, "Rumeysa, please write about us. Please let the world hear our story." "I am keeping my promise, Auntie." She spoke of the painful separations of mothers from their children and families. "I have 3 kids, and it's tough to get by each day." Many women wept day and night, longing for their families. My friends showed me letters from their young children, accompanied by sweet photos of them and mischievous pictures of their pets. Some of the children are in their home countries. Some are waiting in different states with other caregivers, and others have been taken into the foster care system. I learned that women have even been separated from their babies after giving birth. I learned about miscarriages with heartbreak. In the photo, speaking out, Rumeysa Öztürk in Boston on May 10th, a day after being released from the ICE detention center in Basile, Louisiana. In my conversations with women there, I listened to stories of long journeys to the border that involved planes, buses, and boats. I heard tales of people who lost their lives at sea and those who climbed steep hills far away in search of safety. I heard about human beings who walked without food and water for many days. Many shared their experiences of escaping war, conflict, and violence, revealing a painful reality where they exchanged one form of oppression for another. A Catholic friend told me, "Even God cannot hear us here." She prayed night and day just the same. I asked her if it was God who could not hear us, or if it was people like me before this experience who either know nothing about the immigration detention system or prefer to ignore or forget about it. Within this despair, we found small joys in life, like feeding the birds, finding their nest, and hearing them chirp, a reminder of our freedom and the better days to come. Friends made small decorations using bread as clay. They made colorful necklaces and bracelets from plastic commissary bags. Aunts from Russia warmly greeted me with kisses on the cheek, while friends from Georgia gifted me beautiful bracelets and colorful plastic necklaces made with their bare hands. I chuckled as my new friends from around the world playfully offered up their unaware brothers as potential husbands. Friends from Senegal enveloped me in warm hugs, and friends from Cameroon shared the recipes of their favorite regional dishes promising to cook me fufu and eru one day when we are free. In response to questions from Vanity Fair about Oosterk's experience, GEO Group, which runs the Louisiana Processing Center, where she was detained, said in a statement that its ICE support services are monitored by ICE, including by on-site agency personnel and other organizations within the Department of Homeland Security, to ensure strict compliance with ICE detention standards. GEO added that its facilities are never overcrowded and that its support services include around-the-clock access to medical care, physicians, nurses, dentists, psychologists, and psychiatrists, in-person and virtual legal and family visitation, general and legal library access, translation services, dietitian-approved meals, religious and specialty diets, recreational amenities, and opportunities to practice their religious beliefs. The day before my bail hearing in early May, I shared with a few of my friends that I felt like I might be released. That night, I tucked a short letter for them to find under my bed, expressing my gratitude to each of these women for being the wonderful people they are, compassionate, kind, and remarkable individuals, despite the countless challenges we faced. They held on to their dignity and humanity while making a conscious choice to be caring and loving. They uplifted each other, staying strong, even when the circumstances were unimaginably challenging. I learned from these strong women what solidarity looks like. Now I am back in Massachusetts, and I am heartbroken, knowing that each day ahead will continue to be a nightmare for them. No one deserves to live in cramped, unsanitary, inhumane conditions and have their medical needs ignored. No one deserves to have their religious needs ignored. And no one deserves to lack access to nutritious food. I am free, but my true freedom is interlinked with the freedom of many women I lived alongside in ICE prison. As a detainee, I not only endured my struggles, but also had the privilege of connecting with remarkable women who shared their stories with me. Their experiences opened my eyes to a new realm of humanitarian crisis, expanding the circle of grief and compassion in my heart. We Keep Moving. In a Vanity Fair exclusive, Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter reflects on Trump's decision to declassify the civil rights leader's assassination files, her father's legacy, and the future of the movement, by Bernice A. King. Opening photo is of Bernice A. King. On March 28, 1968, I celebrated my fifth birthday. Unbeknownst to me, it would be the last time I would celebrate my birthday with my father. 7 days later, on April 4th, Daddy was assassinated. For years, I tried to figure out, what did my father do? Why did they assassinate him? As a five-year-old, I reasoned that Daddy was a good person who loved everybody and whom everybody loved. Why would anyone want to kill him? People who stood up for the least of these, I reasoned, were not supposed to be killed. I know now that waging a nonviolent fight for justice is dangerous work. As my siblings and I grew up without a father, we were often reminded that he was assassinated while seeking to make the world a better place. And there were more assassination attempts to come. There were assassination attempts on his reputational character. Our mother, Coretta Scott King, prepared us for these repeated attempts, saying, "They keep trying to assassinate your father over and over again." At times, public discourse about my father slithered into slander to undermine the importance and impact of his legacy, and I learned to brace myself for the attempted assassinations by keeping my mother's words close to my heart. By the time we matured into adulthood, we had developed the composure necessary to stand before the nation and the world each April 4th. Laying a wreath on Daddy's crypt reminded us of what can happen when the forces of hate and injustice have no bounds. We watched my mother's example as she continued his work. My siblings and I accepted our roles to advance our dad's work in our own ways. Today, I am not writing in my role as CEO of the King Center to address the government's recent release of assassination records. Today, instead, I wonder why I have to be confronted once again with something that was very confusing and distressing for me as a five-year-old. I am honestly not prepared to revisit the gruesome details of this painful history. For me, there is no real value in it. There is only reliving the trauma. This past January, 3 days after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, which coincided with the inauguration, President Trump signed an executive order to declassify records associated with my father's assassination. Along with those corresponding to the killings of President John F. Kennedy and his brother, Senator Robert F. Kennedy. "That's a big one," the president said of the directive. "Everything will be revealed." The assassination of my father was investigated by the FBI in 1968, by the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s, and then once again by the Department of Justice in the 1990s. The final investigation occurred during a wrongful death lawsuit brought by my family in civil court in 1999. 2 years earlier, my late brother Dexter had visited James Earl Ray in prison and looked into his eyes to ask him if he had killed our father. Ray responded, "No." Despite the official narrative that the FBI and its then-director, J. Edgar Hoover, crafted about Ray's role as the sole assassin, our family believes that Ray was not the assassin, but a scapegoat used by a large and powerful network, one that included informants whom the FBI recruited from within my father's camp. Much of this was corroborated in the courtroom in 1999. After hearing from some 70 witnesses over the course of 4 weeks during the wrongful death trial, a Memphis jury concluded that government entities conspired in the assassination. Our family views that verdict as an affirmation of our long-held beliefs. My family needed to know the truth about who assassinated Daddy. The civil trial provided answers and began to help me answer my childhood question, why? According to then FBI Assistant Director William Sullivan, my father was the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country. I believe the 1962 launch of Operation Breadbasket, a strategic, multifaceted effort to end economic discrimination, along with my father's ability to captivate the imaginations of more than 250,000 Americans at the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on August 28, 1963, heightened the government's determination to assassinate his character through the covert and now infamous FBI counterintelligence program COINTELPRO. This determination was further intensified by his public opposition to the Vietnam War, which he resoundingly conveyed in his speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. Delivered on April 4, 1967, exactly 1 year before he was assassinated, the speech included Daddy's admonishment that the United States government was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. When the government's attempt at character assassination failed, another option prevailed. He was ultimately assassinated. Next photos, under watch. Martin Luther King Jr. is arrested outside a Montgomery, Alabama courthouse, September 1958. FBI file, March 1968. FBI chronology following MLK's assassination. Funeral for the civil rights leader in Atlanta, April 1968, and Bernice A. King. We've got some difficult days ahead, Daddy said on the eve of his murder, a cruel act of state-sanctioned violence. His words were prescient. There are grave risks now, as there were then, in fighting for justice through nonviolence, advocating for the poor, and opposing war. Next photo, looking to the future. King feeding young Bernice during a Sunday dinner. 57 years after he was assassinated, the man who was the target of an overreaching government in search of communism is now honored with a federal holiday and a national memorial on the Mall in our nation's capital. While the country and world commemorate his birthday and multitudes invoke his words, we have not yet, collectively and with earnest intent, embraced and applied his nonviolent mindset and methods. Still, his legacy and influence on policies, practices, and people across the globe are powerful and tangible evidence of the power of nonviolence. We are in touch with his wisdom and must apply it as humanity faces this critical juncture. Kingian nonviolence both galvanizes a movement and exposes injustice. It is needed now more than ever. For these are indeed difficult days, days when my father's very work to create a more inclusive society and economy is threatened with closures and removals of important history, programs, initiatives, information, and services designed to advance genuine equality. Days when aid is cut off from nations grappling with dire poverty. Days when militarism persists and entire families perish. Days when voter suppression goes unchecked by the highest court in the land. Days when thousands of hardworking Americans are laid off in the name of government efficiency. And days when hope lies prostrate and must be lifted and levied by people jointly determined to keep moving. So we keep moving. As a king and the daughter of two global leaders who showed me what's possible when consciousness, compassion, and consistency meet, I keep moving. There may continue to be commentary, cruelty, and controversy for me to navigate. I encourage a collective focus on reviving the revolutionary, love-centered movement that my parents and other courageous, hopeful people cultivated. I implore the global community, which my father called the World House, to think higher, love deeper, and broaden our coalitions for the common good. Most of all, I encourage compassionate action and strategic use of Kingian nonviolence in working to defeat what Daddy called the triple evils of racism, militarism, and poverty. As he said in his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, we still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. This may well be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community. Let us choose community, and in Daddy's words, make of this old world a new world. Chan of Heart by Evgenia Peretz, with illustration of Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan by Diego Malo. In 2015, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan built a philanthropic behemoth in their image, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. Science forward, research backed, driven by empathy. But as Zuckerberg and Meta have tacked right, ditching DEI, Insiders say Chen has become a proxy figure in the battle between her husband's company and their progressive CZI staff. In the photos, April 2011, President Barack Obama with Mark Zuckerberg during a town hall event at Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto, California. July 2011, Priscilla Chen and Zuckerberg at the Allen & Co. Sun Valley Conference in Sun Valley, Idaho. Priscilla Chen met the moment with the kind of grace and sensitivity she'd become known for. It was July 2020. George Floyd had recently been murdered, and staffers at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, the foundation she started with husband Mark Zuckerberg in 2015, were hurting. Tissues on hand, eyes welling up, she hosted an all-hands Zoom to address them. It didn't feel right to not actually just spend the time as an organization acknowledging the, in medicine we call it acute, on chronic, racial disaster that is our country, she said, hands clasped in front of her in a video obtained by Vanity Fair. If there was a silver lining, it was that the moment was so bad, change was imperative, both in the country at large and at CZI, whatever that would entail. That's my little hopeful pearl that I want to try to add. We stand with the black community. We stand with our black employees. It's felt harder and more important than ever to get a lot of our work right. The work would take time, she acknowledged, but she implored her employees to take care of yourself, make sure you're giving yourself the space, the grace. 4.5 years later, Chan appeared at President Donald Trump's second inauguration alongside her husband on the dais, a spot usually reserved for the president's nearest and dearest. Zuckerberg had been cozying up to MAGA World for some time and had just come off an appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast, where he, buff and in a new gold chain, ragged on the Biden administration and lamented a lack of masculine energy in the workplace. But to some, Chan looked uncomfortable at the inauguration, and the optics weren't computing. Through CZI, she'd spent hundreds of millions on biomedical research. Yet here she was, standing a few feet from Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, a science skeptic. She appeared to make small talk with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who was soon to cut billions in foreign aid, including for life-saving HIV treatment in Africa. To many of Chan's colleagues and admirers from the philanthropy world, the image was distressing. To them, Chan represented, perhaps still does, they hope, everything antithetical to the president she was honoring. If Trump was their idea of a nightmare billionaire, Chan was their dream. They knew her to be unflashy and disciplined, driven by the conviction that everyone deserves a chance to overcome the circumstances of their birth. She was profoundly empathetic, easily moved to tears at the suffering of others. What could she have been feeling, some of these contacts wondered, celebrating such a gleefully callous man? Later, Zuckerberg posted a photo of the two of them in black tie on their way to an inauguration party he was co-hosting with the caption, "Feeling optimistic." 7 months into the administration, that appears to be gutting everything she has held dear: scientific research, higher education, public health, caring for those in need. It's hard to imagine that Chan, at least, is feeling optimistic, but she has remained largely silent. Chan declined to be interviewed for this story. Many former colleagues and admirers from nonprofit circles are searching for signs of the woman they knew and floating the questions, "I know they are separate people." And frankly, Priscilla comes off as a lot more human than Mark, says Lucia Reynoso, a former CZI engineer. But they are married and gave the impression of a united front. So, is she aligned with her husband? Has she been ideologically moved by the right-wing plutocracy? Or is she still working toward the greater good, maintaining her silence out of a sense of pragmatism? Next photos, September 2015, Chan and Zuckerberg arrive for the state dinner for Chinese President Xi Jinping and his wife Peng Luan at the White House. August 2016, Pope Francis with Zuckerberg and Chan at the Vatican. If Trump had been president 50 years ago, Chan's parents might never have found their way to this country. They were ethnic Chinese immigrants from Vietnam who had each fled the war-torn country by boat. They met upon arrival in the U.S., married, and settled in the working-class neighborhood of Quincy, Massachusetts. They worked in a Chinese restaurant and raised three daughters. Priscilla was the eldest. At the local public high school, Chan excelled in science and on the tennis court, became valedictorian, and got into Harvard on a full scholarship, the first person in her family to go to college. It was there that she met Zuckerberg in October 2003, standing in line for the bathroom at a frat party. It was not his finest hour. He had just built FaceMash, his Who's Hotter website, featuring images of Harvard girls side by side. The site had spread like wildfire on campus, and now he was set to go before Harvard's administrative board. But one can imagine he fulfilled a need in Chan. She'd felt a sense of awe and alienation upon getting to Harvard, what with all the privileged, hyper-educated kids and private school cliques. But here was one such boy who'd gone to Phillips Exeter Academy, and he was interested. He was a brilliant nerd who, she found, speaks in a whole new language and lives in a framework that I've never seen before, as she told The New Yorker in 2018. He spent the months after they met building Facebook from his dorm room, then dropped out to go to Silicon Valley. Meanwhile, her life path presented itself to her when she met a girl from the Dorchester Housing Project, where Chan was mentoring. The girl's front teeth had been knocked out. It was heartbreaking to Chan, a biology major, and it confirmed to her a calling to serve children in need. After she graduated in 2007, she joined Zuckerberg in San Francisco, where she taught science at an elementary school and then began medical school at UCSF. As a condition to her move, she made him commit to one date night a week and 100 uninterrupted minutes away from Facebook. He was then growing Facebook at warp speed. He'd turned down an offer from Yahoo to purchase it for $1 billion, and now, after an investment from Microsoft of $240 million, the company was valued at $15 billion. Chan told The New Yorker, "I had to realize early on that I was not going to change who Mark was." But she could try to guide him in a world of real-life humans. They spent weekends together doing earnest activities like watching their favorite show, The West Wing, created by Aaron Sorkin, who would go on to write the screenplay for The Social Network, and playing Settlers of Catan, and in 2010, she moved in. By that point, roughly one out of every 12 people across the globe had a Facebook account. Its promise was epic. To do nothing short of connect the entire world, and to help people maintain empathy for each other, as he told Time magazine, where he was named Person of the Year at age 26. In line with his status, Zuckerberg began honing his legacy. His hero had been fellow tech billionaire Bill Gates, who in 2010 launched the Giving Pledge, challenging other billionaires to promise to give away at least half of their fortunes before death. "I encouraged them to start early," Gates says, of early conversations with both Zuckerberg and Chan about philanthropy, noting that Priscilla is leading one of the most ambitious scientific and philanthropic organizations in a generation. Taking his cue, Zuckerberg announced with fanfare on the Oprah Winfrey Show that he would be donating $100 million to Newark Public Schools. The results of that effort were mixed, which educators have attributed to the project's insufficient collaboration with the community. A CZI spokesperson disputes the criticism, pointing to independent research that found improvement in graduation rates and gains in student achievement. Chan later told him that if he was going to be serious about education, he should probably have some real-life experience teaching. At her urging, he gave it a whirl by teaching a class on entrepreneurship at a boys and girls club. Meanwhile, Chan was all in, doing high-stakes trauma work at San Francisco General Hospital. It was gunshot wound after gunshot wound, recalls a close friend. She was the friend who's always exhausted after doing a double shift. She also took part in a special UCSF program designed to improve the health of underserved children. Facebook went public on May 18, 2012. Chan and Zuckerberg, now worth an estimated $19 billion, married the next day. In the photos, May 2019, Zuckerberg meets with French President Emmanuel Macron at the Élysée Palace in Paris. July 2020, Zuckerberg surfing in Hawaii. In 2015, the couple began two major projects, which they made a point of connecting, CZI and their family. After multiple miscarriages, Chan was pregnant with their first child. According to the recent memoir, Careless People, by former Facebook employee Sarah Wynn Williams, whom Meta has legally blocked from personally promoting the book on the basis that she has potentially violated her contract, while Zuckerberg and his team were in Indonesia, he floated the idea to his co-workers that he might not be present for the birth, not that there was any particular conflict. Just that something more important might come up at work. He relayed that he'd spoken with Chan about the possibility. As Wynn Williams claimed, Chan told Mark that she would be totally fine with him skipping the delivery, but that he might come to regret missing the birth of his first child. Mark was, of course, present from the beginning to the end of all three hospitalizations and deliveries for all three of their children, says a source close to the couple. This was not something they discussed. A few months before the birth, in September 2015, Zuckerberg attended a White House dinner and spoke with President Xi Jinping of China, where he was desperate to launch Facebook. Wynn Williams claimed that he asked if Xi would do him the honor of naming his unborn child. Xi declined. They ended up naming the baby Maxima, Max. Zuckerberg had long been fixated by the Roman emperors and would go on to name their other two daughters, August and Aurelia. Careless People is a mix of out-of-date and previously reported claims about the company and false accusations about our executives, a Meta spokesperson said upon the book's publication. Next photos, January 2024. Zuckerberg speaks during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing titled Big Tech and the Online Child Sexual Exploitation Crisis on Capitol Hill. February 2024, Chan and Zuckerberg look on as Amanda Lemos of Brazil grapples with Mackenzie Dern in their women's strawweight fight during UFC 298 at the Honda Center in Anaheim, California. Max's birth coincided with the unveiling of CZI, which shook the philanthropy world. At its founding, the couple wrote a public letter to their new baby that both spoke of the promise of science and was suffused with Obama-era feel-good progressivism. Our hopes for your generation focus on two ideas, advancing human potential and promoting equality, they wrote. Promoting equality is about making sure everyone has access to these opportunities, regardless of nation, families, or circumstances they are born into. They announced they would be giving away 99% of their shares in Facebook in their lifetime, then valued at $45 billion, to the organization. The mission was to fix almost everything. On the science front, CZI would help cure, prevent, and manage all disease over the next century. To Corey Bargman, the first CZI head of science, that audacious goal was a meeting of the couple's essences. Zuckerberg was the big-thinking engineer, and Chan the pediatrician, driven to find the often elusive answers to ailments afflicting young patients. She was really motivated by this idea to help children, says Bargman. And there were just children you could not help, because there was no help. And for her, science is hope. CZI zeroed in on the goal of creating a human cell atlas, a reference for understanding every single cell in the human body, of which there are 37 trillion. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.